And Newhall, you took this case by appointment, did you? Thank you very much. You have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client. Thank you. The last case this morning is I won't try to pronounce the name. It's versus Holder. Mr. Linder.
Joyce Nabin. Good morning, Your Honors. You have to excuse me. I've been recovering for the last 3 days. So if I do end up coughing, I give my apologies in advance.
You don't spread it to the bench, that's it.
Well, I think I'm over it, but you never know with these things. The Chicago weather has been quite a shock to me. Coming from Philadelphia, I thought it would be about the same, but that is not true. In any event, the issues and the position that we have is basically on three concepts, but the first one deals with fundamental fairness and how that plays, if at all, in regards to the exercise of discretion. And the second is the actions of the government in the process. And when I say the word the process, I'm thinking in terms of not just the deportation process, but even after the deportation process, the removal process, the entire process. And then the third thing.
Before you go any further,
yes.
Let's talk about our problem on review.
Sure.
How do we get beyond the 90-day limit on motions to reopen? I mean, was there any argument preserved that the Patels come within any exception to the 90-day limit?
The issue that we have and that we refer to, and I think the court has a case on point that the government mentioned, is regarding the sua sponte authority of the BIA. And I understand that it's discretionary, and that kind of discretionary decision-making is not reviewable. But the argument that we're making in that situation is that the definition is reviewable. For example, if the BIA said, we're not going to exercise our sua sponte authority on discretionary relief, but only we will grant it for people from old Europe, or only for white people, well then, that obviously the standard that's being applied for the definition can be reviewable. And my argument here is I'm showing you that one part of the government found that they did meet the standards of discretion, and that we have a second contradictory part of the government that's literally the right and left hand that's saying that they don't, and that the BIA did not go into any of its reasonings as to why discretion was not exercised. What we do know is that this is a type of case where discretion would be exercised. It's already been proven. The government themselves granted the administrative stay on a discretionary basis. We know the Morton Memorandum, which is an internal document for the INS, but the reason why I mentioned the process is because I believe how the government acts is reviewable. And so in my particular situation, I feel the BIA did not act. I think it did act arbitrary when they just simply put the one line in saying that they're not going to consider the sua sponte authority. Here we have a couple. We have a week actually – you know, literally grandparents, been here for 20 years, have children here, the government has failed to affirmatively try to enforce. They have not been hiding. They've actually been obvious. They've been filing applications. They've been going personally and reporting. The government actually granted an administrative stay. And I just don't understand what standard, if any standard, the BIA is using for its sua sponte authority. So I don't think the issue is whether or not we can say that we have a change of country conditions for asylum. You know, in the argument of the government's brief, they say it's change of country conditions, not personal condition changes. I understand that. But what I do think here is we have the government acting in a contradictory way, and we have the BIA, which has not seemed to identify what, if any, standards they're using for the exercise of discretion, when in fact a portion of the government has already said that they meet the exercise of discretion. At some level, they've already made the decision not to enforce a deportation order, to grant the stay, and then when the stay had to be renewed, to grant another year of the stay. So from my perspective, I don't think the issue is about the 90-day. I think the issue is really about the BIA cannot have unlimited, no limited authority. At some level, their exercise of discretion has to have some level of definition. And that's why we cite the one case, which is a BIA case, which does have different facts, but stands for the same principle. And the principle is that in a situation where you have, I'm going to just read the quote that we quoted, an intentional lack of enforcement of the final order of deportation, it is appropriate to consider this factor in deciding whether or not proceedings should be reopened in the exercise of discretion. And so what our argument is, that's on page 8, what our argument is that the BIA didn't do that. They just simply said, no discretion, we have no reason why or understand why. I feel that here with the fact pattern where we have government action, we also have people that were making their presence obvious and known. We also have petitioners being in the United States for 20 years, U.S. citizen kids, U.S. citizen grandkids, permanent residents. A lot of equities have been developed by all these years that have gone by where the government has not just failed to affirmably divorce, but actually has said, we're going to grant these administrative stays. And the BIA makes no mention of this in their denial. They just simply say, No, we don't find they meet exercise discretion.
There were long periods where the Patels stayed in the country where there was no stay involved. They simply didn't leave voluntarily when they made order to do so. Extremely long periods.
Sure. Their addresses were very rarely changing. But going back to that issue, you know that they had their appeal and that they ended up losing their right to appeal. I understand that there was some findings from the judge that are against their equities, but they wanted to appeal that. They hired an attorney to do the appeal. And again, another factor that goes towards discretion, their attorney failed to file a brief, and they lost those rights. So, again, when we go back to viewing if this is not a case where discretion could be granted, what is the case where discretion can be granted? I mean,
but isn't discretion ultimately non-reviewable?
Well, I think discretion itself is non-reviewable, but the application of the definition of, like, for example, the application of the definition of what is the discretion for sua sponte authority is. So, for example, if the BIA was only granting sua sponte approvals to white people, that would obviously is an example where it would be reviewable. Why? Because the definitional standards that they're using to apply. And I'm saying here that there are none that are indicated by the BIA. You can't read the BIA decision and come up with a single reason why they made the decision not to grant discretion. And in this case, where we have the government themselves granting discretion at some level, which is exactly what we're asking for, by the way, in the sense of they have to show that they have significant equities and ties and that they're not fugitives. So in this case, I believe the BIA abused its discretion in how it defines it. I don't think there is a workable definition at the BIA, and I think at least they have to cite why in this case they are not granting discretion. I think the fact that they just put a couple words in, that's literally one sentence long, and that's it, that's where our issue falls.
Thank you.
I'd like to make one more point.
Sure.
The government also talks about the Morton Memorandum, which we think we fall under. They say, look, that's an internal policy of the INS, ICE. I understand that. But again, where you have one portion of the government saying one thing, another avenue saying something different, I believe the inconsistency of that and how the definition of that is applied, I think government, if they're applying these memos and these internal policies in a fundamentally unfair way, that is reviewable. Not that you should be getting involved in looking at the words of the Morton memo and deciding whether or not that's a proper memo or not, but here what we know is that Morton memo lays out certain criteria. Administrative stay was approved, and if something is inconsistent being done by a different part of the government, then I think that is fundamentally unfair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She?
If it pleases the court, Dan Shea on behalf of the United States government. If it pleases the court, we have just two arguments for why this petition for review should be denied.
Before you do that, because I don't want to break my record of interrupting people today, would the Patel still be eligible for an exercise of prosecutorial discretion by DHS? And if they would be, how would they go about seeking that?
Your Honor, I believe they did seek prosecutorial discretion.
Oh, I know, but I'm wondering if there's still any opportunity here.
I think they can certainly continue to consult with the Department of Homeland Security, and if they decide to exercise that, they can contact us. But as of right now, the record shows that the FIRD action request was denied in this case.
Yeah. I mean, you know, well, my problem is that there are all these bad people out there who are running around, and these are good people, it certainly seems. And
Your
why
Honor,
is our government doing this? But never mind, that's...
Well, Your Honor, I think a couple things bear pointing out. I think I don't know why DHS declined to exercise prosecutorial discretion in this case, but we would note that that is within the sound discretion of the department. But on top of that, there are factors that cut against a positive exercise of prosecutorial discretion. For instance, the petitioners were found not credible, both of them. And the petitioners argue that, they weren't hiding. You know, the government never bothered to remove them. But they actually requested and were granted voluntary departure in 2004, almost 10 years ago. And from 2004 to 2011, the whole point of voluntary departure is that you voluntarily depart. And then to argue now that the government never bothered to look for them is disingenuous.
What's the effect of the I-130s that have been approved? Tell me what that approval of an I-130 means and how that affects the situation. Because isn't the government taking some steps recognizing that they have a claim to remain here through that?
Yes, Your Honor. So what's at issue is the provisional unlawful presence waiver. That's what they're claiming they're prima facie eligible for. That particular waiver came into effect, I believe, January of 2013. So it's a relatively new provision. And there are certain things that you have to have to qualify for that waiver. Basically, it allows aliens who enter the country without admission to be able to adjust their status. You can't adjust your status if you were never granted any type of visa whatsoever. You just kind of came in without being inspected or paroled. This allows those aliens to go back to their home country, and they'll have this waiver, and through this waiver they can expedite the process to come back to the United States to adjust their status. But the waiver itself isn't available to aliens subject to a final order of removal. And so the I-130 certainly is part of what you need to show in order to be eligible for this waiver, but then there's a whole list of aliens who are not eligible for the waiver.
Should they have been issued an I-130 given their current status?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and the petitioners argue this in their brief, but the I-130 approved is not in the record. So it may exist, but I can't speak to that on this record. There is no I-130 that's approved in this administrative record.
Well, if the record were supplemented, if it's a fact that it exists,
right,
and the record were supplemented,
sure,
how does that affect, given the fact that it's approved, the I-130, how does that affect the equities, or at least the argument of the petitioners that there's been an inconsistency by the government?
Well, again, it doesn't, because an I-130, the only thing you need to show to get an approved I-130 is that the relationships are legitimate. You know, if you're sponsored by a daughter who's a U.S. citizen, well, what you need to show to get the approved I-130 is that you really do have a United States citizen daughter. it doesn't go to whether or not the petitioner has other disqualifying factors in their past. So, for instance, if the petitioner was an aggravated felon, again, USCIS wouldn't look at that when they were deciding the I-130. We would also note that the grant of a stay by the Department of Homeland Security for the petitioners to go about obtaining this waiver isn't inconsistent with their ultimate discretionary denial of prosecutorial discretion. Here, the letter itself that the Department of Homeland Security issued states this stay of removal is not an immigration benefit or a form of relief from removal. They clearly are simply giving the aliens a chance to pursue this administrative waiver. Now, what's interesting about this case is that the unlawful presence waiver, which is their best chance of coming back in the country and adjusting quickly, wasn't enacted into law until 2013. So there was a lot of comments, if you look at the Federal Register, on, well, what would this unlawful waiver, who would be eligible for this waiver? And if you look in the record, the letter from DHS granting the stay was in 2012. So I think, you know, that officer could have been looking at the record and saying, well, we'll give you another year. We don't know if, you know, what's going to ultimately end up in this unlawful presence waiver, what would end up in it, and giving them time to consider it. But here, the board, having looked at their case, they didn't just deny it for no reason. They said, well, you're actually not, you haven't shown you're eligible because of this particular statute that says if you have a final order of removal, you can't get an unlawful presence waiver. So they really brought nothing before the board to show that they're eligible for any form of substantive relief. And just briefly, we would note that the sua sponte argument was never raised before either the board or this court. So it's certainly a valid you can raise it, but it wasn't. And because it wasn't raised, their failure to exhaust administrative remedies means the court can't actually consider that in the first instance. But even if it could, I would note that no court has ever held that the board's decision not to exercise the sua sponte reopen has ever been reviewable. No court has ever held that. And no court has ever held that the Department of Homeland Security's decision not to grant prosecutorial discretion is reviewable either. So if Your Honor have no further questions,
I think so. Thank you very much. Linder, how much time? You have about a minute, Mr. Linder.
I have 3 minutes? Oh, one. I thought I reserved three. Okay, well,
You reserved three, but you used up to two of the three.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge.
Finish your argument.
Okay, real simple. First, I agree with you. They actually came in and brought me in warm cookies before I left. These people are very good people. But I understand the court situation. We did raise the argument of this discretion and sua sponte on page 8 of my brief. But going back to the BIA decision, the BIA said, look, we note in regard that respondent seeks reopen and administrative closure. So the BIA acknowledged that if they did reopen, the administrative closure would solve the problem in regards to making them eligible for the 601A waiver. So at the end they say with a deportation order they're not eligible, but if the BIA exercises discretion, that would solve that problem. As far as a possible solution here, I agree. I was actually shocked that we didn't get an offer of prosecutor discretion. I have another case that we just got an offer on that's not nearly as significant as this one in the Third Circuit. I'm thinking what maybe can happen is I did have a brief discussion. You mind if I reiterate that discussion? I did have a brief discussion, and that's what I said to him. I'm like, I've been doing this for 17 years. I've never seen anyone want to, you know, this is a situation here where this should be granted. I don't think it was actually looked into, because when I filed the administrative stay, I also filed for deferred action. I personally met with the officer that made the decision on this, and he said to me, the deferred action is going to be a lot of paperwork and complicated. We can do it a simple way with administrative stays. Every year I come back, and I'll grant you another year. So I don't think there was ever a true balancing with the deferred action. Now, that's not in the record, but what I think could be a possible solution is if the court can stay on its decision-making for a short period of time, let me have an opportunity to possibly revisit this. If you're the government is willing, I do think this is a case where prosecutor discretion might be done that
could solve the problem. You're asking the court to not expedite this decision, but to...
If opposing counsel is willing to make a phone call, because I'm going to send the request to him. I understand that he says it's not in his preview, but normally what I've experienced is in situations where cases are a bit sympathetic, they'll make a phone call, and we'll make a phone call and see if we can't get DHS to change his mind on this. That's if counsel is open to that idea.
Time frame. Well, let's do this. I believe I can speak for the court, and we will hold it in abeyance. But give us some information. 2 weeks would be soon enough, or need more time?
It's because of the time of year, Judge, with everyone taking with the government, I would say at least 30 days would be what would be needed, if possible.
30 days.
All right. If you That's are okay. willing to entertain this possibility.
It's beyond my pay grade. So.
Well, I understand. I won't make you commit to it, but I'll give you 30 days.
Listen, it may be beyond ours, too.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. Sorry about exceeding my time.
Thank you. Have a good trip back to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
I wish I were going with you.
We've actually had very warm weather.
I grew up in Philadelphia. I love Philadelphia.
Did you?
Yeah.
What part of Philadelphia?
Germantown.
Oh, well, you know what? My grandmother was from Germantown.